It's The World This Week. The World This Week in partnership with The Daily Beast. Joining us from Istanbul, Borzo Dargahi, international correspondent for The Independent. How are you?
Good. Great.
You had to think about it. Joining us as well, Lila Jacinto, senior editor at France24.com. How are things?
Good. I don't have to think about it.
You don't have to think
about it. It's
Friday. It's Friday. Jeremy Stubbs, deputy editor of the French news magazine Causeur, with us as well. How are things?
Not looking good. I'll be using that expression later on.
Not looking good. Uh-oh. Let's see if that's contagious. France 24, Washington correspondent. We love visitors. France 24, Washington correspondent. Kedavan Gorgestani, thanks for coming to the mothership and gracing us with your presence.
Thank you for having me back.
All right. The World This Week, which you can always catch on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and other fine streaming services. It's a tragedy that we all saw coming. Was it avoidable? A record 27 killed in the English Channel Wednesday when their overcrowded inflatable dinghy capsized. But with the stepped-up dismantling of makeshift camps around Calais and an ever-increasing security presence, the migrants insist it's Britain or bust. A vigil taking place Thursday in the French port of Calais there. And we heard migrants say, we've been through so much, Lila Jacinto, that we have left Syria, we have left Iraq, we have left Africa, we've been through so much. Crossing the English Channel is not the hard part for them, they say.
Oh, yes, this is constantly repeated that we are going to even try again. In a way, it's almost like these are migrants who want who have families there. The cell of the UK as well plays in here. The UK is seen as a multicultural country where they have tea and samosas, and there's football. So there is a pull of UK as well. And this is true that it's getting increasingly hard on local communities in Calais, this groundswell of migrants. But this deadly disaster, should really have politicians on both sides of the channel really get together to sort this out. And, we can talk about the ways that this can be done without getting into this war of words.
Politicians say they don't want the pull factor of lots of migrants coming to their border. And what we've heard from migrants we've spoken to is we have no choice, particularly as they militarize their approach, constantly confiscating tents and sleeping bags, constantly closing down makeshift camps. Where else can we go except we have to try our luck? We can't stay here, is what they're saying, Jeremy Stubbs.
Yes, well, that is certainly what they say. And one could almost compare this to the medieval myth of the Children's Crusade, people crossing a continent in hope of some sort of paradise at the end of it. And what they find on the other side is often not paradise, even if they get there. This is it's an impossible situation. One would like to say that this situation was avoidable, but it wasn't. It was inevitable. Until earlier this week, there were only 21, I say only 21, advisedly, drownings that we knew of, and now it's been more than doubled in one day. And there is no visible way yet of finding a common solution. I mean, this tragedy has brought a new sense of urgency, but it's not brought us any new knowledge about what to do to stop it. So I will say my piece. It's not looking good.
Borzo Dargahi, where you're sitting in Istanbul, you're kind of at the midway point for many of those migrants, leaving places like Afghanistan and Syria before they head towards Europe. What's been the view there about the events unfolding in the English Channel?
Well, I mean, I think that there was someone discussion of the inevitability of all of this. And I have to say that I disagree. I think that, you know, you talk about the pull factor, you talk about the logistics and so on, but you have to look at the push factor. You have to look at the fact that these people are escaping countries they love, cultures they love, because of war, brutality, famine. If you look at each of these individual situations, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan, Somalia, all of these places where the migrants are coming from, these are places where the West has had a hand in exacerbating or ignoring festering conflicts that create so much misery that people have no choice but to get up and leave and make these perilous journeys across deserts and oceans and so on in hopes of, if you talk to them and you ask them, what do you want? Why are you going? They inevitably say they want a better life for their children so that their kids don't have to suffer through what they suffered through. And I think that, you know, if there is a way of making this kind of thing inevitable, this kind of tragedy inevitable, it starts with addressing the push factor.
Yeah, so you have, on the one hand, those talking about the push factor, as Borzoo describes it, Kedavan Gorgestani, and on the other hand, those who say, well, the problem is the smugglers, same as with the Mediterranean, same as with the U.S.-Mexico border, which you cover.
Yes, and you're seeing really, we're now focused on this latest tragedy, but you see this happening around the world, and you see the same debates, the same questioning about what they call in the U.S. the root causes or the push factor. Why are these people leaving? How do we deal with the origins of pushing these people to make that perilous journey? But then you also have to deal with what is happening currently at the border in the U.S., in Calais right now, in France. So you're really seeing this repeating itself over and over with politicians who are trying to address it in some way. But the question is, what the root causes, dealing with the root causes, is something that will be time consuming. It's not going to fix itself right away. How do you deal with the current issue? And you were mentioning the fact that they're militarizing it, they're removing tents, they're trying to lock it down to prevent people from crossing. But these people want to go, and they're going to keep coming, and you need to figure out a solution immediately and a solution in the long term.
And add into this mix, well, a post-Brexit bitterness, just when authorities seem to have toned down the rhetoric. The British Prime Minister Thursday going public with the letter that he sent to Emmanuel Macron, which Boris Johnson argued for France to systematically take back all illegal migrants who cross the channel. Quote, this would have an immediate effect and would significantly reduce, if not stop, the crossings, save lives by fundamentally breaking the business model of the criminal gangs. The suggestion enough, or rather the fact that it was posted on Twitter, enough for Britain to be uninvited to next Sunday's meeting in Calais of nations that border the North Sea.
2 days ago, I had a serious discussion with Prime Minister Johnson. I'm surprised when things are not done seriously. We don't communicate between leaders via tweets or published letters. We're not whistleblowers. Come on now. Ministers are going to work seriously to solve a serious issue with serious people. On Sunday, Minister Darmanin is holding a meeting with his counterparts from the European Union and the Commission to work on this subject, and then we'll see with the British how to act effectively if they decide to be serious.
Jeremy Stubbs, why did Boris Johnson take to Twitter for this?
Well, I think there are two reasons. Firstly, there is a personal bitterness between these two leaders. And Boris Johnson seems to be in the mood where he's ready to do anything to antagonize
But it didn't seem like that earlier on Thursday. The rhetoric seemed to have been toned down. There was talk between the Home Secretary in the UK, the French Interior Minister. Why send that tweet?
Well, I think it's a question of who's doing the talking. And this is where, as a colleague of mine said, it's getting hormonal.
We have to work
to a great extent.
Friends, with our,
there is
with our
a certain personal, I wouldn't say rivalry, but a sense in which each man sees the other as their biggest, I wouldn't say enemy, but a pain in the neck. And we've seen already that Mr. Johnson, over the AUKUS business, doesn't really care too much about Monsieur Macron's feelings or his public image. Possibly he feels that he was slighted himself at some time. If you add to that three different issues that are bound up with each other, Northern Ireland Protocol, the fishing, and now the migrants, it is a very, very messy business. But I think, if I can say it with a nautical metaphor, we've hit almost rock bottom now.
Yeah, let's hit rock bottom, but will we start to dig is the question, Leila Jacinto. Is this, it's just personal between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron?
It is personal, yes, but it's not all personal. I mean, this is all the fallout of Brexit. The fishing, apparent, definitely so. And this is really an outcome of, Boris Johnson conducting politics like he's writing a column in a newspaper.
As he once did.
As he did, yes. So, you know, this cavalier way of putting things out on Twitter, offering nothing new, offering, sort of points that have been rejected by France as a solution. And this focus, you know, to come back to what you talk about, you know, the focus on criminal gangs and smugglers, they are really a small part of this entire issue. And, you know, the right wing agenda of focusing on these criminal gangs and smugglers. Smugglers will happen wherever there is a market, and sort of just looking at it merely as a criminal problem, as trying to stop the migrants in, instead of really thinking about solutions. You know, processing asylum claims, for instance. You know, Borzu talks about people coming from fragile states, minorities in countries that are ruled by autocrats. They do have asylum claims. This is a long-standing issue. You know, we all said it; we knew it was coming, and there is just no dialogue.
Borzu Dargahi, breaking the business model of criminal gangs. You've covered conflict in Syria and Libya, where there's plenty of smugglers. Your thoughts on that?
I've talked to people, smugglers in Libya, in Turkey, in Afghanistan, and so on. These are small-time guys who are, and in their mind, it's interesting. In their mind, they think they're doing God's work. I've heard that again and again and again, and saying, you know, wallahi, if I didn't do this, someone else would, and I feel I am providing a service to these people. As unethical as what they're doing, you know, these are not like these honorary mafia gangs and so on. These are, so often people who are migrants themselves who are trying to make a little bit of extra money engaged in a business like this. And inevitably, when they're arrested and put before the cameras or you know, their biographies are published in newspapers, it's rather unimpressive. You know, these are not like big criminal operators. They're just, you know, losers themselves. And, you know, they're in their own ways, they're victims of this whole immense tragedy as well.
All right. And as Jeremy Stubbs was mentioning, it's not just migrants poisoning cross-channel relations. Half a dozen French fishing boats this Friday blocking ferries in Calais and the Normandy port of Ouistreham, as well as disrupting traffic in the Eurotunnel. And we're talking about this context, right? This toxic climate. You get the feeling with the fishermen, be they British or French, it's kind of the equivalent. They have this. It's not a big economic clout, but a huge symbolic value for both the British and the French, kind of like with the coal miners in the U.S.
Yes, and you're seeing really some of these stories that are maybe not as important or as big, but they bring out these very nationalistic values. And in the context of Brexit, of course, you have this fight between the UK and France. And so it's the fishermen, it's migration, it's all of these stories. And you were talking about that slight between the two leaders and the personal aspect of it. And the AUKUS deal also brought out some of that sort of rivalry between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron. I mean, the words that were exchanged during the AUKUS deal, there was a lot of anger towards the United States and Australia. But remember what they were saying about Boris Johnson when the French were asked, why aren't you so angry with the British? And they were kind of saying, well, we sort of were expecting it from them and they don't really matter. And so all of this just adds up and piles on to this rivalry between these two countries right now.
Yeah, the baggage of countries bickering, it's not good optics when we face a common foe, and that is, of course, the coronavirus pandemic. Here we go again. New travel restrictions popping up around the globe as authorities scramble to buy time in the face of a variant that was unknown a week ago coming out of southern Africa.
Early indications show this variant may be more transmissible than the Delta variant, and current vaccines may be less effective against it. It may also impact the effectiveness of one of our major treatments, Ronapreve.
Of course, it's early days, and we're not doctors, Jeremy Stubbs. We don't know, for instance, if it's more lethal than the previous ones, but the fact that we're doing it all again, next week there's going to be a big World Health Organization conference, and we've already heard from the likes of former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark and former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf saying, if the world had come together and gotten vaccines for everyone, we wouldn't have new variants. We've perhaps pushed by at least a year back the end of this pandemic.
Yes, that's quite possible, because we know that generally, the rate of vaccination in Africa is far lower, even in South Africa, which is comparatively advanced in terms of technology. And we knew that as long as the virus was circulating, there would be more and more mutations. And bang, we've got 30 all at one go. It's going to take a few weeks to find out just how dangerous that is. In other words, just in time for Christmas. And currently, we know that South Africa, they're working to retroengineer the Moderna virus, because they weren't given permission to use it. And you can work on it up until a certain stage of experimentation, but if they want to stick it in people's arms, they're going to need a license. And that is obviously the core of the problem here, is getting the vaccines out to these people.
Yeah, and Kedavan Gorgestani, when you see that here in Europe, we're now thinking of following suit after the United States and giving vaccines to children as young as five, the World Health Organization saying, hey, wait a minute, children aren't the priority. The priority is, as Jeremy was pointing out, the developing world.
Yes, and there is that debate, and the U.S. was criticized early on when Joe Biden announced that they were going to start this booster campaign back in September. He got hit very hard by the WHO, basically saying that it was like handing a life vest to someone who already has one when you have other people drowning without life vests. But the American side is, we know this is coming. We knew that we were going to have another wave. And our priority is first to defend the American people. But at the same time, they insist, which is true in numbers, the Americans have given the most vaccines around the world. They have distributed a lot of vaccines, a lot of doses around the world. Not nearly enough, of course. But their idea is that they can do both at the same time. They can vaccinate Americans, boost Americans, as well as give those doses around the world to poorer countries mainly. But the Americans are saying, we wanted to get the boosting started early, and they were right in that case, because right now you're seeing about, I think the latest number is about a quarter of eligible Americans for a booster shot have gotten it. Mm. And so their idea was to get ahead of the wave that we're seeing coming through Europe, which is likely to be arriving in the U.S. very soon. And that was the goal for them.
Yeah,
but also protecting the patents of the big pharmaceutical industries. I mean, you know, there are countries in Africa and Asia who can very well produce their own vaccine. And that is the center of it. And every time this comes up, Joe Biden, comes firmly on the side of where Washington has always been. We need to preserve these patents so that, R&D and research and development can go on. And at a time of a pandemic, we said this, it's going to be 2 years now that we are as safe as everybody else on the planet. But ultimately, we're also as good as the profits of the big companies.
But Borzo Daragahi, earlier we were speaking with our correspondent in South Africa, and They're quite angry because they feel as though, first of all, the first case we have out of Belgium, the guy hadn't even been to Southern Africa. He'd come from Egypt. We don't have all the science yet. And they're saying, here we are, back to travel bans. A reminder of what the world was like in March of 2020. And we said it afterwards, in hindsight, that the travel bans were not effective. And yet here we are, the EU is banning travel to 7 Southern African countries.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is politics and trying to appear responsive to what they consider, you know, domestic political demands. And meanwhile, on the other hand, just within the EU, I was just last week in Bulgaria, which has despite abundant supplies, has less than a quarter of the people vaccinated because of vaccine hesitancy and anti-vaxxer sentiment. Some parts of Bulgaria within the EU are less than 12% vaccinated. And meanwhile, you know, despite urgent worries about a possible variants emerging within that climate, those Europeans are allowed to travel anywhere in the EU.
Yeah, and Central Europe, not just Eastern Europe, but Central Europe, certainly did not need a new variant when it's already trying to save Christmas. What with a return to a lockdown in Austria as of last Monday, and Germany's outgoing government setting up a special transitional team with the incoming coalition with the Social Democrats.
Getan, unser Ziel muss sein,
our aim should be to avoid the introduction of this variant as much as possible.
This is the last thing
we need in our current situation, an additional variant to add to the wave.
And by the way, Jeremy Stubbs, when Olaf Scholz on Wednesday came to the rostrum to say we have white smoke, we have a three-way deal, it's the first three-party coalition since the 1950s, his first words were about the COVID pandemic, not about what was in the platform that they'd agreed upon.
Well, yes, and of course, as you said, Germany is very worried, and I just think that we're facing here what is the big test of the power of the modern state today, because in a sense, the way out of this would be to impose vaccination on those who need it, as we've heard, not vaccinate people who don't really need it, and get vaccines out to other people. We are not necessarily following that path because there is too much resentment against COVID restrictions. We've seen in Rotterdam, for example, recently, the lengths to which people will go. And one could
imagine. But is that a boisterous few? I mean, is that? I mean, it's a minority that's loud and vocal.
Well, exactly. The trouble is in the modern state that loud minorities can make a lot of trouble, as we saw even with the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vests. And I think that there are a lot of leaders who are afraid of this kind of thing getting out of hand when, in a sense, you know, they've shown they've got the muscle to impose certain restrictions, but will they go all the way? That is the question.
Lila Jacinto?
Well, I mean, you know, this is the carrot and the stick too. I mean, do you entice people to get vaccinated, or do you slap measures that are punitive? I mean, what actually strikes me about these, and yes, these are these vocal minorities that are taking to the streets, but another thing about this pandemic that also strikes me, because on the one hand, you have the developing world just absolutely desperate for vaccines, And then you have the developed world where, you know, there is such a sense of privilege and entitlement that all sorts of public health measures are just too much for citizens to bear. And this, and the sort of, you know, the state of the citizen in these countries where, you know, information is not top down, you know, so social media, everybody is in an echo chamber, and you know, the individual that has incredible rights and is, you know, is not willing to listen to the opinion of the state and public health experts, and you know, this has just got exacerbated with this pandemic.
It's something that's been said in the build-up to next April's presidential election here in France, Kedavan Gorgestani, a breakdown on the part of a part of the population in trust in authority, in trust, and although in this country we've seen grumbling, but people have gone out and gotten their shots, not like in the U.S., obviously.
No, but they also decided at some point that they're going to restrict what you can do if you don't get, so it's not a direct mandate, but it basically made your life pretty hard to live if you didn't get a vaccine, and that's when we saw people moving. That's something that even the Democrats do not want to get anywhere near. Joe Biden did what he could with the federal part of the government. He mandated for the federal workers. They're trying to entice companies to do that for their own workers, but they don't want to get anywhere near forcing people to getting vaccinated.
Let me ask you about this, Borzo Dargahi. How do you gauge what is a vocal minority and what is a silent majority?
I think that's a really good question. We do have opinion polls that by and large show that the majority of Americans, Western Europeans, and people across much of the West and the rest of the world actually generally agree with the mandates and the requirements and so on, with sensible, measured public health measures. The problem is not just that they're a vocal minority. The problem is that they're, you know, they're rather dangerous. And this whole anti-vax and anti-vax measures and mandates issue is becoming a sort of gateway drug to extremist politics and, you know, far-right politics. And that's really the dangerous part. And I think that a lot of Western governments aren't recognizing just how radical these people are becoming and how dangerous they're becoming.
Moving on, it was the week that a Nobel Peace Prize winner announced he was off to fight a war. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed relegating day-to-day duties to his number two so he could go to the front and join the effort to stop Tigrayan-led rebels who say they're intent on marching on the capital, some of the fighting less than 200 kilometers now from Addis Ababa. On Friday, these images of Abiy in fatigues appearing on his official Twitter account.
What you see behind me is a mountain area that was a stronghold for the enemy until yesterday. Now we've managed to clear the area fully. The morale of the defense force is really great. The war is being undertaken with great effort. Now we have taken Kasagita.
Now, this is, again, from the official Twitter account of Abiy Ahmed, so there's no way to verify. Your reaction, though, when you see those pictures? For 2 days, we were wondering if he'd really had gone to the front.
Well, when he made that announcement, I was at once reminded of Chadian President Idriss Deby, who was killed on the front line. And when that news broke, a lot of people...
Both military men.
Exactly. But I remember a lot of people who were, you know, who were not familiar with West Africa went like, what is a president doing on the front line? And now we have, another great leader on the front line. Took a while for these images to come out. But Abiy right now is controlling the narrative more than ever. Just today he had, there was even more censorship, which would even cover journalists, you know, trying to figure out where are the rebels and what's the position. If you report anything that is not passed by the Ethiopian authorities, you are guilty of supporting the terrorists. You know, this is also the classic moves of leaders who do not want to engage in any sort of dialogue. So to have a Nobel Peace Prize winner now on the front line using a rhetoric where I cannot even see how the two parties will come to the table for some sort of a dialogue and discussion. So Abiy has just decided that this is a zero-sum game. It's incredible.
He's not the only one. And yes, the war effort does include celebrity endorsements. We've seen this week Ethiopia and perhaps Africa's greatest ever long-distance runner, Haile Gebrselassie, who announcing that at age 48, he too is ready to take up arms. Kedavan Gorgestani, you heard Lila talk about for the government side it being a zero-sum game. The same is perhaps true for the rebels, and the fog of war has drifted as far as Washington, D.C., where there's a big Ethiopian diaspora.
Yes, and over the past few weeks in Washington, every time I went to the White House, especially on the weekends, there were these big protests. I mean, you always see protests in front of the White House, but this latest one on Sunday where I was there, there were probably maybe a few thousand people in front of the White House, mainly pro-government Ethiopians who had signs saying the U.S. stop supporting the terrorists of TPLF, stop sanctioning the government of Ethiopia, stop sanctioning the government of Eritrea, stop basically taking the side of the TPLF. And there was a press conference from the U.S. envoy to the Horn of Africa just on Tuesday. He came back. He was during the weekend in Ethiopia speaking to the two sides. He came back and he was asked about the situation. And he was trying to, he repeated over and over again during that briefing that the U.S. was not taking sides. He said that this information out there, these accusations that the U.S. is trying to favor the TPLF over the government is totally false narrative. And what they're trying to do is get the two sides together. He did say that there was very little progress in the fact that both sides were actually talking to the Americans. But he also said, I don't want to sound overly optimistic because the situation on the ground is extremely concerning to the Americans. And you've seen the messages from the U.S. Embassy to U.S. nationals in Ethiopia saying, you need to get out now. We will not be able to get you out later.
Yeah, that's part of the resentment against Western chancelleries, Borzo Daragahi, is these travel advisories to citizens to leave Ethiopia. Again, it's the optics don't look great. You heard Kedavan there talk about the U.S. envoy Jeffrey Feltman, and it made it sound like neither side, again, wants to sit down.
I mean, this is such a horrible tragedy. The entire Horn of Africa, not just Ethiopia or Eritrea, Sudan, even Somalia is sinking again back into despair and war and so on. And this was a region that just a few years ago was not only like a little bit of a success story, but becoming a magnet for some emerging market or frontier market investing. So what's happened is you know, really awful and really tragic. But I think that if you talk to some people, and I'm not an expert on the Horn of Africa, but some very smart people that I have spoken to about it, say that one of the reasons for what's happening in that whole region is the U.S. disengagement, Western disengagement and apathy during the Trump years. And we're basically reaping the harvest of not having any attention on this very fragile area, not having any sort of robust diplomatic engagement with these governments, with these countries. If we recall, the invasion started in that dangerous, the war started in Ethiopia during that dangerous interregnum, during the right after Trump was defeated in the elections.
Yeah, the day after.
Was focused on what was happening in the U.S. And so, you know, this just sort of shows what the famous adage that, you know, nature abhors a vacuum.
Yeah, it's that age-old question, isn't it, Jeremy Stubbs, which is the West gets accused of getting too involved, and then, in this case, accused of doing nothing, or by doing nothing, the accusation's been leveled that it gave a free pass to both sides to ratchet it up.
Well, that's it. A damned if you do and damned if you don't, as it were. But of course, when Mr. Abiy came to power, there was a great wave of hope. I mean, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. Everybody thought, this is the man who's going to change everything. And of course, the fact is, though, that it was these internal tensions, these ethnic tensions, and the Tigrayans having a greater share of power than was proportional to their population was, I mean, not necessarily their fault, as it were, but that's the start of it all. I think that that there are more internal tensions here than foreign delinquency at work. But the trouble now is that how do you come in, how do you intervene when really you can't see one side as being the good side and the other as being the bad? You can't pick sides, so what do you do?
I agree. I mean, there are very few good guys in this. You know,
but you have to do something, because otherwise, if you have a balkanization of Ethiopia with the spillover effect on neighboring Sudan, which has issues of its own these days, what do you do?
Well, I mean, Ethiopia is, you know, prides itself on the only African country that was not colonized. It was not colonized, but it's always been a very difficult mix of, they call them nationalities, of different ethnic groups. And there has never, it's always been a case of one ethnic group being on the ascendance. When the TPLF was in power, they had an extremely shoddy human rights track record. What amazes me is that that Abiy did not, as a statesman, see the TPLF's military power. You know, the TPLF is an enormous fighting force. When you're talking about the Horn of Africa, it is the Tigrayan fighters that have been in peacekeeping missions in Somalia, and they're always considered among the most reliable battalions. You know, when the TPLF left the Ethiopian military after this crisis happened, you know, you saw the Ethiopian military just collapse. And now we have Abiy on the front lines, you know. But in terms of even the military power, he just decided that the National Army had the might to take on the TPLF, which is just a miscalculation on his part.
All right, we're going to continue, of course, to follow this story. Before we go, he's been a thorn in the side of Turkey's president for a long while and paid for it dearly. An Istanbul court rejecting international calls to free businessman Osman Kavala, who's also a philanthropist, a social activist. He spent 4 years in jail without going to trial. In that time, two cases against him have been dropped, only for fresh charges to reappear.
My biggest concern is that this current situation will become usual. It will be normalized and it will be deemed as normal. I would like to stress that this situation shouldn't be regarded as normal.
Borzu Dargahi, there was a rare court date where you are this Friday in Istanbul. The next one's not till January. And basically, the judiciary is not blinking in the face of that international pressure. What's this all about?
I think that there is a personal vendetta on the part of Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, against Osman Kavala. He has called him, quote-unquote, Soros scum, referring to the billionaire philanthropist George Soros. And basically, I don't know, no one knows really what the root of this obvious, a very emotional reaction is on the part of Erdogan, but it seems like every time the judiciary tries to do the right thing, which is basically drop all charges against this person because there's really literally no evidence that supports the contention that he was responsible for the 2013-2014 Gezi protests against Erdogan, nor any connection, even more absurd, the 2016 coup attempt, which was basically conducted by people who were Osman Kavala's ideological and political enemies. There's literally no evidence that has been presented or shown in any kind of court or anything like that. And despite that, he's still being held in prison in rather tough conditions. No one is quite sure why the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan is so adamant about keeping this gentleman in jail.
Yeah, Turkey's president threatening with expulsion recently. 10 Western ambassadors, including the French, U.S. and U.K. representatives. And this for protesting the detention of Kavala. He's one of the founders of the Turkish branch of George Soros's pro-democracy Open Society Foundation.
All the while, they say it, Kavala, Kavala, Kavala.
Kavala, Kavala, Kavala.
The person you call Kavala is the Turkey branch of Soros. 10 ambassadors came to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs just for him.
Kervan Gorgeous, what is it about George Soros's name that sets people off?
I don't know, to be honest. I can't answer that question. It really seems that it's the go-to fall guy whenever you want to dismiss an opponent of some sort, I feel.
Jeremy Stubbs?
Soros, well, he doesn't have a very good reputation in Britain, but for other reasons. That's to do
with He bet against the pound.
But I think that in this particular case, it's Mr. Kavala's vision of history that is probably the real problem, because by his cultural activities, by the kinds of things he's sponsored, even into archaeology, it's a very open vision of Turkish history, which does not correspond at all to the very selective and manipulative vision of history that Erdogan wishes to impose. And we've seen that in many of his recent symbolic demonstrations.
I absolutely agree. You know, culture is a very important plank of what Erdogan, as, you know, a nouveau Ottoman sultan, is part of his agenda. But he is a very effective populist leader. And whenever the going gets tough, he...
Like when the lira drops 15% in one day this week?
Exactly. And you will know that, you know, when he stands to lose an election, when there are economic problems, he is very effective at pulling out a populist card. And Kavala is definitely being used right now because the Turkish lira is in free flow. Although the Gulf is now coming to help Turkey, but the economy is really his prime problem.
All right, and of course, don't count Recep Tayyip Erdogan out is a safe way of ending the show. Leyla Jacinto, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank as well Borzo Darigahi in Istanbul, Jeremy Stubbs, Kedavan Gorgestani. Thank you for being with us here in The World This Week.